Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. I shifted in the chair and took a deep breath. I guess that me was clown number two, or better yet, David the no longer innocent. Nah, that's too moronic. How about David the Bartleby CO? Yeah, that's rather cool. At any rate, another player on Pablo's chessboard. I rolled my neck slowly, and as it popped and visions exploded in my head and my mind was spinning like a ball on a roulette wheel, the sudden ing-gong-ging-gang of the Eau de Kirk bell yanked me out of the chair and forward toward the window, and my focus shifted to the outside world. It took a moment to adjust to the warping and blurring and waving of everything in my field of vision. My nerves were tingling. The sun broke through the clouds again. I lifted my face to soak in the warmth beaming in from outside. The warmth permeated my entire body and loosened my taut muscles. The buildings were in motion. A BMW cruised up the street below. Just like the BMW Hassan was driving the morning we left Ankara heading east. On that April morning in 1977, a freezing wind is blowing dust in miniature twisters across the bleached land, and ahead of us are sun-baked hills with stone and mud houses scattered throughout, and in the distance lie looming white mountains, and the bright sun gives the illusion of what lies ahead as a shimmering landscape with a ripple of white rising beyond. "This could be dangerous from here, David John," Hassan says. "It is still winter, and there are bandits in the mountains. The road has much ice, and they can easily stop cars on the road. There are still many gypsy types in the mountains. Yes, it is true. 4 months ago they robbed and cut off the heads of 3 tourists. So when we go, we take 3 or 4 cars. The bandits only stop the single cars. There is no problem." Then we're driving on in silence for about an hour, and Hassan turns to me, smiles, and says, "The next 12 to 18 hours will probably be the worst. All Iranians are afraid to go through this country in the dark. When they go during the day and in caravans. They're afraid of the bandits. Maybe I think I will be one of the first to cross alone in the dark. What do you think? This is adventure, yes?" "I think we'll make it. Inshallah, God willing." We're driving into the hills, climbing steadily as mounds of arid brown-yellow soil and rock roll smoothly into mounds of a darker purple-brown, shadows growing longer. We pass a grave. The road's now empty. The land looks cadaverous. "You see what I mean?" Hassan says, shifting gears. "There are no cars. This is the really dangerous part. These people that live in the mountains, sometimes they come down to the road at night. They can look from far away and see if a car is alone. Then they can put a huge stone in the road to stop it. Many people have been killed for being so stupid. Maybe we can find a bus in Sivas and follow it. But don't worry, David John. If they come, I know what to do. I'm not afraid. I will just run over them and kill them. I'm crazy enough to do it. The bastards! Sometimes they come after you in an old car and pull over in front of you, but if that happens, I will not let them overtake me. I will run them off the road. This car does not matter when it is life or death. The bastards! It is very dangerous when you have something on top of your car. So many Iranians are crazy because they bring so much back from Europe with them. It's like inviting the bandits to come after you. I have heard many stories, but we will make it, inshallah. Maybe we will stay in Sivas." The road has many potholes and rocks, but Hassan's in control, and I'm feeling secure with him at the wheel as the BMW seemingly flies over the road, avoiding the potholes, and we're climbing higher into the hills where strong winds are blowing. We pass sparse wind-sculpted brush, thin patches of snow, and an occasional mountain village where the soil has been worked by hand. Darkness is now on us as we stop in Amasya, a remote village, for gas and tea. Inside the tea house are some fat Turks playing backgammon, smoking cigarettes and hookahs, take a hit off my own cigarette, and drinking tea. They have oily skin and long eyelashes. The tea house has a rancid, sweaty smell. We're on the road again, and Hassan has me take the wheel. There's no traffic. My brain's filled with Hassan's stories of decapitated tourists, and I feel an accumulating excitement. Shadows along the road jump at me. Around every corner lie expectations of a boulder or log with 50 bandits prepared for plunder. I have a sense of alternating abstraction and terrific concentration. Hassan retakes the wheel after about 3 hours. "You drove well, David John. Your concentration was good. It is not easy to drive this road. It is not for the unafraid or the meek. It is very dangerous here. But if you like adventure, this is it. I think I am the only Iranian to ever travel this road at night. The truck driver back there in Amasya, the one carrying the cars, he told me I was crazy. But I told him I'm not afraid. Allah is with us." We're in the high mountains. Snow is everywhere, and the road is icy. At the top of a high ridge, there's a crude restaurant, the only stopping point for many miles. We stop for tea. The owner is an amiable man and speaks with Hassan about the condition of the road. We warm ourselves by his fire. After a few minutes, we continue. The weather changes. In a matter of seconds, the clear sky turns into a blinding snowstorm. The driving snow shoots against our windshield like thousands of tracer bullets. Hassan deftly turns the car around and guides us safely back within a couple of kilometers of the restaurant before we're forced to stop. We cover ourselves with our sleeping bags, lock the car doors, and wait for the storm to subside. I wake feeling as if sealed in a tomb of white. Hassan wakes about the same time. We crack our windows to see light flakes of snow still falling, but without the intensity of the night before. We get out to clean the snow and ice off the car. A few yards away are three men, one on a half-dead horse and the other two to one side, staring at us through steely black eyes. They're wrapped in worn and dirty sheepskin coats. Long knives protrude from their belts. Hassan tugs at my elbow and whispers, "Kurds, mountain gypsies, you stay here and let me talk. They will not do anything as long as they don't know what we have. You get back in the car and reach under your seat as if you have a gun. Don't show any fear and all will be well, inshallah." Gripping the table in front of me, I do as told. Hassan walks within a few feet of the three men and stops. He speaks to the man on the horse, the elder. They exchange a few words. Then Hassan returns to the car. "Reach in the glove box and give me my wallet. Do it slowly. While you do it, keep your eyes on the horseman and stare in his eyes. He thinks you have a gun, and he must keep thinking that. He wants 20 lira for sleeping on his land, the bastard. But we must pay. There will be no trouble that way." Hassan walks back and hands the horseman the money. They say something to each other. The Kurds turn and disappear slowly into the sea of white. Hassan returns, gets in the car, and starts the engine. "That was very close," he says, letting out a long breath. Then he laughs. "So, what do you think, David John? This is adventure, yes? We were lucky. Allah was with us, but I knew what to say. I praised his horse and his fine sons, the filthy bastards. I spit on their graves." He said, "We're on a ridge, and the road is better in a few kilometers. We must try the road, or he may be back with more Kurds." Hassan eases the car slowly into motion. An ominously beautiful white surrounds us. The outline of the mountains is indistinguishable. Snow flurries blow crossways, making it difficult to see. Hassan's concentration is remarkable. He guides the BMW as if he knows the road instinctively. Soon the road becomes easier to mark as we descend from the peak. Then the road rises again. The wind increases as we approach another peak. Snow flurries envelop us. Four trucks are stopped near the peak. We have to stop with them. One of the trucks moves out. Everyone follows, going on the assumption the road can only get better. In a few kilometers we can see ahead and discern three buses in the distance. The road is icy, but there is some traction as the road is full of rocks and potholes. For the next 4 hours our progress is the same, 20 to 30 kilometers per hour, Hassan maneuvering the sliding BMW ahead of the trucks and buses for fear of not being able to start again if forced to stop, the road rising to summits where wind flurries are a blinding white and hurt the eyes, then dipping to lower elevations where boulders of slush and white mud crash against the sides and frame of the car. Always Hassan finding areas of the road with traction where other vehicles can't and are forced to stop. At one point we pass Salur, a mountain village of about 25 rock huts covered with snow. The land around us is more remote and beautiful than anywhere I've ever seen, but I wonder how these mountain people can survive the winters. We hit another low elevation and Hassan begins to speed over the muck and slush of the rocky road. Suddenly we smash into flocks upon flocks of small brown and yellow birds. Van Gogh's crows transformed? I wince and swallow hard. Sun disappears behind the clouds. Room grows colder. Shivers run up and down my spine. There are thousands of them on the road, drawn to the warmth of the mud. Hassan plows into them. For a good 20 kilometers this continues, Hassan speeding along at 120 kilometers per hour, honking, braking, flicking his headlights to scatter them, the birds fly in all directions like a grotesque parting of the Red Sea, the sky is full of birds, hundreds of them ricochet off the windshield, the headlights, and the front bumper, making dull, thudding sounds. It begins snowing again. It's a morbid scene, snow pellets shooting at us and an endless wall of birds pitching away from us. No escaping these birds, no way out. Where's the fucking wheat field? Hassan's laughing. Some hungry man will have a feast. The sparrow meat is sweet and good. Then his tone changes. I don't want to kill them. They are too nice. It is spring for them, too. They want to live. But as the order of nature, I cannot stop and wait 2 months for them. The birds disappear when we reach Erzincan, a foul city full of beggars, mud, slop, and neglect. We continue without stopping, a look of disgust and hatred written on Hassan's face. We drive on into the savage white land. About an hour from Erzurum, we come to the worst part. The road is solid ice. At the top of an incline, there has been a wreck involving a bus and a truck. Other cars are pulled over. Several bodies are stretched out on the side of the road. A few peasants are attending the injured. We cannot stop, David John. These peasants are doing what they can for those who are hurt. We can do nothing more for them. Most of them will die. It will take more than a day to get them to a hospital, and there are no real doctors in these mountains, only those who perform suspicious medicine and take your money. It is sad, but we must continue. Besides, these are Turks, and they would as soon kill us and take our money and car and leave the others to die anyway. We pass the scene slowly. Rivulets of blood streak the snow and drip in the corners of my mind, uneasy now, feeling as if a violent thunderstorm is approaching, ready to unleash its fury. Those who notice us stare with hollow and lifeless expressions. Now we're behind a group of trucks and some cars driven by Europeans, and the procession is moving slowly up another steep incline. Hassan's pissed off again. These idiots! People think it is so easy. They drive these cars from Germany to Iran for 500 marks. They play with their lives. They make it dangerous for others because they're afraid. They are stupid idiots. Hassan maneuvers the BMW, slipping and sliding on the ice, to the front of the pack. All along the road, cars are pulled to the side. Only Hassan manages to keep moving. We approach another incline, but have to stop when a truck forces us to the side of the road. We can get no traction to go forward. Hassan backs to the side of the road, where a foot or two of gravel is exposed. Another 2 feet to the side is a steep precipice. Snow begins falling again. An icy wind stirs up more flurries. I get out of the car, and within 30 seconds am covered with snow. I push while Hassan guns the car up the incline. I run after the car, slip on the ice, catch up, open the passenger door, and jump in. At the moment we cross the top of the incline, the BMW runs out of gas. We coast down the other side for 7 kilometers to Askale, where, luckily, we're able to buy some gas. We push on until arriving in Erzurum, where we spend the night in a squalid hotel room. The next morning we leave the city. The roads open and we're traveling in a caravan of 6 cars. Hassan takes the lead. We take an alternate route that leads us into the mountains on the way to Agres near the Turkish-Iranian border. In the high hills is a honeycomb of caves filled with outcast families. The BMW passes stone huts with turf roofs and cone-shaped earth mounds where mountain people dwell. We descend to a lower area. The sun breaks through the opaque sky. The ice on the gravel road is melting. Here and there are trucks off the side of the road, stranded as no vehicles can rescue them until the snow melts completely. One tipped-over truck has a tent pitched next to it. There are about 10 scavengers milling about. Half are children, the rest harridans and worn-out men. They see our car approaching and begin walking toward the road. The walkers move through the snow as if in a trance. Thin and ugly people, coarse-featured, thick-lipped, insolent, savage-eyed. They look as if they're waiting for something, hungry for something. We lock our doors. Hearts pounding, grinding my teeth, old woman's voice rises up from the street. Grim-faced, Hassan guns the accelerator and races by them. Some of them pound on the BMW with their fists and grab at the windows as we pass by. A man would be a fool to travel this at night alone. It would be inviting death, Hassan says. My hands are shaking. My body feels like ice. Mine too, frozen, solid, petrified. Jesus! I don't look back. On and on we continue. The others in the caravan have safely passed the scavengers. Time passes, and we come to the top of an icy pass where at least 50 trucks are stuck. At the bottom of the hill, 2 trucks are completely off the road. The road's not wide enough for the 2 trucks to pass each other, but they tried anyway and failed. Now all the other trucks are backed up in both directions. It appears there's just enough room for a small car to squeeze through. Hassan gives it a try. Near the point where the 2 trucks slid off the road, we hit an icy patch. Hold on tight, boy, we're losing it. The BMW swerves to the side of the road into a snow-filled ditch just behind one of the trucks. We get out and begin digging. 8 of the truck drivers help us get the car back on the road. We're caked with mud and our hands and toes are nearly frozen. The others in the caravan make it through safely. We're on our way again, but the trucks will probably be stranded for days along with the traffic that stacks up behind them. We drive on without incident. A few times we pass a truck stranded off the side of the road, but see no more scavengers. The only life we see is an occasional flock of black and white sheep tended by dark shepherds who live with their families in stone huts built into the sides of the snow-covered hills. We enter Agres, another squalid military outpost where Soviet tanks and troop transport trucks are scattered on the sides of the road. We stop in a back-alley restaurant. Hassan inspects the kitchen before we eat kebab with rice and cream yogurt. We're about 3 hours from the border. The road grows worse. The potholes become larger and more numerous. We're at the back of the caravan. Trucks approaching from the opposite direction splatter the BMW with slush and thick brown muck. It's blinding and makes driving difficult. One truck sprays us with small stones and the windshield cracks. We climb atop another plateau to find 2 of the caravans stopped. One of the drivers, the German, has been forced off the road and hit a boulder sunken in the snow. He has a flat tire. The other man is one of the Iranians, a strong and quiet man whose arms ripple with muscles. A raging wind blows snow flurries over the road. The temperature is below zero. Wearing only a light sweater and no gloves, the Iranian changes the tire. The German watches in awe. Behind and below us lies an ocean of white. It's as if we're floating on top of a world of clouds. The wind howls. Heads exploding, swallowing colors of sound. We're back on the road, trailing the other 2 as darkness approaches. Hassan's on another tirade. We are moving too slow. When it is dark, the road is too dangerous. These stupid idiots. We will be lucky to make the border like this. But we must travel in a pack because their spare tires are being used. If something will happen to another tire, it can be their death. They will freeze or the bandits will come. Fucking bastard sons of bitches. Look, David John, he doesn't know how to drive. He's afraid. He crawls through the holes in the road like a coward dog. He must go faster. It's worse for the car to go the speed he's going, the bastard. Look how he brakes when a car comes at him. I see these freaks all the time. They get paid 500 marks and think it's like driving in Europe. Sons of bitches. He makes it dangerous for everyone. We drop out of the last elevation to the lower ground. We're out of the snow. The road is muddy, but getting better. We pass 2 more villages of mud hovels where wild dogs roam the streets. Finally, we reach the border. Hundreds of trucks and cars are backed up. We'll have a long wait to cross over into Iran. My body was all tensed up again, and I was gripping the window sill. I sat back down in the chair and lit another cigarette. I tapped the ashes into the ashtray several times, concentrating on the sound of my finger against the cigarette. So who was that me? David the wandering hippie? Spiritually alien and adrift in an alien world, as Pablo said? I got up again, groped my way into the bathroom, turned on the tap, and splashed water over my face. I looked into the mirror and saw a grotesque image staring back at me. Van Gogh's self-portrait with all those swirling colors. Jesus, that's me in India. I returned to the chair, plopped down, and closed my eyes. India, good God, India. Now there's that beggar woman being led down the aisle of the train coach, and she's on a leash and being lightly twitched with a willow stick by the man who is holding the leash. Her head is shaped like an ugly, distorted pyramid with the jaw and mouth forming the base. I'm looking up toward the eyes, now the forehead, and now the top of the head where it narrows to almost a flat point. A metal band is wrapped around her forehead. Moving in spastic jerks, she places her right hand in front of her and makes grunting noises in the way of begging for money. No one seems to pay her any mind, but I'm gawking and can't take my eyes off her. I've never seen anything like this before. For Christ's sake, doesn't anyone even care? A porter ushers the two of them to a third-class car containing various animals. Another passenger nudges me with a grin and says, "Untouchable." "Pardon me?" "She is an untouchable. That band was placed around her head at birth so the brain would not grow. It is the only way she can bring money to her family. Her life is good only for begging." "That's sick. I want to strangle this guy." "That is India." The train arrives at the old section of Delhi. A seething swarm of people surrounds me. Everywhere skinny brown rickshaw drivers and hawkers of cheap goods clamor for attention. One swoops me up, takes my duffel bag, hooks it onto his bicycle rickshaw. "Is he that clown? I can't get away from him. Why is he dogging me like some kind of irritating asshole? Malcolm, get him out of here!" and drives me to a bizarre area where I can find a cheap room. Now we're passing through narrow winding streets and wide bazaars littered with debris and thick intimate odors, filling the air as women in tattered rags with cracked yellow feet and rings in their noses stand cooking stews of baked vegetables over smoky fires, and children run back and forth, some pissing on their toes, and Jesus Christ, look at all the cripples walking the streets there alongside half-naked natives with elephantiasis, with jaundice, with pellagra, with paralysis, all scooting about or assisted by various wooden supports and carts. Thousands of people with rickets, leprosy, skin diseases, and bloated bellies are moving through the filth of the streets, and old English buses, bicycles, scooters, taxis, horse-drawn carts, camel-drawn carts, human-drawn carts, all carrying different cargo, are competing for limited space, and there's an elephant ambling down one street, its rider seated upon a hudao. My senses are assaulted on all sides. Now I'm in a brick cubicle in a ramshackle hotel, and the only furniture is a charpoy bed, and in the corner is a squat toilet. There's a single window overlooking a narrow street in the bazaar and the tumultuous crowd in the street. The heat in the room is suffocating, and I've got to get out of there. What's happening to me? Dear God! How long is this going to last? Why me? What am I doing here? Is this my life? Now I'm out there walking the streets for the next few days, and everywhere there's poverty, hunger, disease, violence, nightmare, misery, and I'm walking through the refuge quarter of the city to stare at the chained-off society as if it's a perverse circus sideshow. Poverty-stricken and diseased people are living there in houses built of tins and boxes. Their faces smug, their eyes shining with a sleek look. They seem almost glad of their misery, and they're scattered all about in every pose of contorted collapse. Look at those people with catalepsy, with tuberculosis, with syphilis, with all sorts of worms and eye diseases, and look at the old men sitting there, wrinkled and hideous and staring back at me, and look at the others lying prostrate about those chained-off streets, their faces gaunt and colorless. When they close their eyes, they look as if they're dead. My God, the lepers are spotted head to foot with sores that are covered with a dirty, whitish foam, and there's an awful stench pouring forth from their putrid limbs. Some of them are clawing their fingernails upon themselves in a frenzy over their itching skin. I can't take much more of this. I'm going to lose my head. I know I am. I'm down to my last $100 and riding a bus from Delhi to Calcutta, and one vista is shifting into another, my head spinning from the displacement of hill and air, of haze and all the shades of green and brown, and along the road there are all kinds of animals and people, green parrots flying across the road, fat black water buffaloes ambling slowly along, monkeys and apes performing acrobatics on the cornices of houses, elephants and zebus half asleep deliberately stepping between staring, waving groups of people, peacocks shrieking at the bus, half-naked figures squatting around flickering fires, preparing evening meals, bandy-legged men in the bus spitting betel juice from their red lips through the windows. There's no end. I'm in Calcutta now, and it's a mass of tenements, hovels, temples, mosques, shrines, warehouses, shops, and factories, and hanging over the city is the smoke of thousands of cow dung fires, and crows. Crows, my God, more crows, those awful black crows. Vincent, why are you doing this to me? Yes, crows are prodding the bodies of those who have neither the willpower nor the energy to destroy themselves by their own hands. As some do, like that one man who leaps in front of a train pulling into a station, and after the train passes he's on his back, his legs amputated at the waist and bleeding profusely, his hands extended upward, his wild shriek sounding like the laughter of a madman, which reverberates in my head. Terror and fear of my own powerlessness grip me. Ego's dead and gone now. Will is threatening to turn against itself. Was he me? That alter ego clown? What? before he finally collapses and his lips move for a moment as if he will speak, and blood flows fast from his mouth, and then he lies still, his eyes open and staring wildly at the sky. Tears gushing down my face, room is stuffy, try to breathe slowly, deeply, try to open my eyes, they won't, they insist I ride this roller coaster through to the end, car shifts gears in the street, voices rise up, but they're still far away, and this India shit is so damn close, run away, train, gotta ride it out, gotta ride it out, and now I'm passing through a leper colony that's on the other side of a railway bridge, and not far away is a vast garbage dump where some of the lepers lie on beds inside mud huts with their limbs bandaged. There's one boy sitting against an outside wall, his arms and legs smeared with a blue ointment, and next to him another child whose finger stumps are raw and bleeding. And now there's a woman using the gray stump of her hand like a wooden spoon to stir a pot of steaming liquid. Two sobs explode from my chest like poison. Later I'm walking along the Hooghly River, and it's silted badly from the ashes of cremated bodies. Garbage lines the streets, and more than once I see resting in the piles of garbage a dead baby whose skin's parched and cracked. Another heaving sob. It's just too much. I buy a bottle of rot-gut wine from a black market dealer, get drunk, and pass out on the streets. God, let me die. There's too much suffering in the world. At least that's what I was thinking when I was living that nightmare long ago. But really, what was it I learned from all that horror? The horror. Oh, the horror. Yes, it was the look in the eyes of those people that scared me. Not so much their physical suffering, but their own acceptance of their suffering. Yes, that was it. The acceptance of their own suffering. That's what I saw. And what scared me most was they felt no pity for themselves. No one there felt pity for those suffering souls. And what I saw in their eyes was pity for me. Yes, pity for me and all my superior Western morals and values and upbringing and education and way of looking at the world. And despite all that, I, perhaps as a symbol or representative of the culture I came from, that same culture bent on consuming the raw materials of the earth and prosecuting so many wars and sacrificing thousands of her own while killing millions from other cultures, not found a place in the world while they had. Oh yes, that scared the living shit out of me, let me tell you. And I knew my life was worthless at that moment. All life was worthless. And from that moment on, a huge question mark was violently placed on top of everything I'd ever believed in, and I guess that me is David at the bottom. And Pablo, how can I rearrange that character and those events? Eyes blurred from tears, fumble for another cigarette, take a long swig of beer, room is shaking, I'm shaking, trees and walls shaking. It feels like an earthquake in here, a real goddamn earthquake. The mushroom slammed my head forward to January 17th, 1995. There I am in Kyushu with Kaori about 7:30 in the morning, and we've just turned on the TV. At first there are some pictures from a news helicopter hovering above Kobe and trying to assess the earthquake damage. The newscaster is telling commuters in Kobe and Nishinomiya to stay home as some of the main lines are closed. Gradually, the nightmare images start appearing. A collapsed section of the Hanshin Expressway, trains flipped on their sides, many sections of track snapped in two or torn loose, cars catapulted off the toppled sections of elevated expressway, pancaked commercial buildings in downtown Sanomiya, ruptured water and gas mains, entire neighborhoods engulfed in flames, the numbers of dead, missing, and injured rising into the hundreds, then thousands. And we sit riveted to the television all day until I finally tear myself away about 1 a.m. because I'm tired and have to work the next day, and I wake at 5 a.m. to Kaori's sobs and get up to embrace her while she points to the TV screen showing the inferno engulfing Nakatoku and cries out, "That's where I used to live. I know people who live there. That's where I used to live." I swallowed hard. No time to think of a name for that me, because it's suddenly 3 years later and I'm getting up early on another January morning, my arthritic ankles and sprained knee taking longer than usual to function. I'm taking a painful, teeth-grinding bicycle ride in the cold to the hospital and arrive at Kaori's room at 10 o'clock to see her laughing and joking, already the cheerleader for all the patients on the cancer ward. The nurses come in later to prepare her for surgery, and they stick a tube down her nose, give her a shot, wash the polish off her toenails, dress her in a green smock and nightcap, and put her on a gurney while outside in the hallway several patients line up to wave and cheer her on. Then the nurses wheel her out of the room and into the hallway where Kaori waves at everyone and says, "I'll be back soon," in Japanese. "Kaori, you were so brave that day." A lump forms in my throat and tears well in my eyes as we take the elevator to the second floor, and there's barely time to lean down and kiss her before the nurses wheel her into the operating room. The 2 hours in the waiting room drag on for an eternity before the surgeon finally appears and calls me into a side room, where he outlines on a whiteboard the details of the surgery and explains that everything has gone according to plan except for one detail. The tumor was slightly larger than anticipated, so he cut out a larger section than planned, including the duodenum. There he is showing me the removed section of Coyote's stomach. It's in a Tupperware container filled with ice, and the mass of pink matter looks like a flattened squid with its tentacles cut off, and I can see the cancer itself looking like a pale bruise on the pinkish slime, and it has little white strands spreading outward, and the surgeon's handling the stuff with wooden chopsticks. I feel like I'm going to be sick. At that moment, Coyote is wheeled out of the operating room, barely conscious, her eyes glazed over, and she makes a weak attempt to flash the V sign before being wheeled into the intensive care room. I'm allowed a few minutes at her bedside, and I touch her arm and say, "Can you feel me?" And a barely audible, "Yes," escapes her mouth as she smiles weakly, then says, "I'm cold." "I love you, Coyote, I really do. Where would I be without you? What would I have done if I'd lost you?" 100 more vignettes marched across the stage of my mushroom mind, a phantasmagoria of my entire life, from Little League baseball and high school basketball glory and family relationships in the early days, on to prison dramas, the journeys far and wide, all the characters of those multiple episodes, and all the intellectual explorations of why, what is the meaning of all this, the mind twisting left and right down philosophical and religious avenues, and then finally reaching the stage where I wasn't questioning anymore, just merely accepting that all things, all experiences, all people thrown onto my path at certain moments had been absolutely natural, preordained, and perhaps even my own personal angels sent to guide me, and at that moment I was enlightened, for Christ's sake. And my face was one big Cheshire cat grin, and all was right, I felt right, and I thought, yes, it's great to be back again. Then came the crashing boom, boom, boom of someone knocking on the door, which propelled me into the kind of paranoia that has the potential to go wrong, and you have to deal with decisions, game playing, and all kinds of imaginings of what the interrupting people, straight people who now surround you, are thinking and planning concerning your own miserable little existence, and... what? Gotta move. Gotta snap out of it long enough to go straight for a moment. Take up the challenge and confront this intruder. I took a deep breath, willed the body to move, and found myself shouting, "Just a minute!" And suddenly giggling, because there you have it. I just took control of everything, like I always had. And now I was walking over to the door and opening it, and... whoa, Nelly! There was a beautiful young black maid in a maid's uniform, smiling and asking in a melodic accent, "Would you like me to come back later, sir?" "I can come back later." And her face had a glow around it, like everything else, and behind that smile lay the history of Africa, and I felt an immediate warmth and security in her presence. And all I could do was just smile and say, "Yeah, come back in a while. I'll be going out soon anyway." And she smiled and said, "Okay," and turned around and disappeared into a fog of dark orange shadows, and now I was back more or less in the present again, and had a new energy prodding me to move it, to get out there in the world and dig on all these strange people.